All right, everybody. I am very excited to bring Jameson Lopp to you all, Satillionaires, here today. He adopted Bitcoin very early. He takes us through an incredibly deep understanding of Bitcoin, how it works, why it's valuable, and where he thinks it should go next, along with some practical tips for stacking your first sats, securing them. It's an incredible show, and we have an absolutely brand new flavor of Ithaca
Look
hummus
at this.
to debut today on the show. This is the collaboration between Ithaca hummus and Grasa olive oil. So here's Jameson. Welcome to Sat Chats, the Bitcoin podcast where we chat about sats. Sats are the smallest part of a Bitcoin, the same way pennies are the smallest part of a dollar. With Sat Chats, we're building the world's biggest Bitcoin welcome center to serve as your gateway to generational wealth. So if you are new to Bitcoin, we want to chat about sats with you. Hit satchats.com to grab your slot in the studio today. I'm your host, Stuart, Bitcoin Maxi, who wears prescription sunglasses to protect you and your loved ones from my Bitcoin laser eyes.
And I'm your co-host, Chris, founder and CEO of Ithaca Hummus, proud multi-coiner and Bitcoin smash buyer.
So smash that like and subscribe the same way Chris smash buys Bitcoin. We have a big show for you today. Three big things are going to be happening. Number one, we're going to announce a brand new giveaway on the show. We are trying to reach 999 plus one subscribers as soon as possible. And when we do, we will choose one from among you and drop 1 million sats on your face. We are going to turn you into a Satillionaire overnight because we are that focused on helping each and every Satillionaire out there stack their first sats on the show. So
Let's do
make
it.
it happen and you might get 1 million sats. Number two, we have a brand new flavor of hummus to try on today's show. Never before seen, and we'll keep it in the shadows.
Yeah.
But really, the biggest news is that we have Jameson Lopp on the show today, who is our very first Bitcoin heavy on the show. So we're going to be hearing Jameson's Bitcoin story today. But before we do, Jameson, maybe you can help our Satillionaires get to know you a little bit.
Sure. So, I am a native North Carolinian myself. My family history goes back to the 1700s, I believe, on my father's side. As we were talking about before the show, third generation Chapel Hill alum. And I studied computer science at Chapel Hill, and that was really one of the entry-level things that got me hooked into Bitcoin because I was working in Durham, North Carolina, doing software as a service, web development stuff, checking out the nerdy news sites on the daily, and this Bitcoin thing just kept coming up. And of course, I dismissed it for probably 6 to 9 months, assuming everybody was going to lose their money, it would end in tears, and kept coming up, eventually decided I should read the white paper. And that's really what blew my mind from a computer science perspective, because Satoshi solved this problem, this double spending problem, which I had never thought of before. I had never really concerned myself with the inner workings of money. But when I saw how they solved the problem, I was like, this is pretty crazy because it seems like it works, and yet it's the exact opposite of how a classically trained computer scientist would go about trying to solve the problem. You really inverted everything on its head because we are trained to solve problems as efficiently as possible, to use the least amount of computational resources, whether that's CPU bandwidth, memory, disk space, whatever. And Satoshi said, you know what? We're going to spend a ton of CPU resources and we're going to spend a ton of bandwidth by flooding the entire world, this global network of nodes with this redundant data. And so, from a computer science perspective, I see Bitcoin as the least performant database structure that I've ever come across in my entire career. It's a horrible, horrible database from performance perspective, but you get some really interesting and unique properties as a result of some of these trade-offs. And as we can see, you know, over the past 15 years, this has turned into a trillion-dollar industry, just building on top of that really, really solid foundation, which is a terrible database.
So you're saying that the classically trained computer scientist is going to try to have the most efficient footprint possible, but Satoshi's idea was to flip it on its head. And I guess, are you saying that since everyone has like a copy of the blockchain on their node and they're all checking everybody's work, like basically there's just like 20,000 redundant copies mm-hmm. of the blockchain on all these nodes, and through the inefficient use of computing resources, you get something very interesting?
Yeah, both from that redundancy, which means that you have to have pretty low throughput to ensure that everybody can run a node and we can all sync and validate the data on computers that are affordable to the average person. And also the proof of work mechanism. It's the exact opposite of efficient. And in fact, the whole idea is to make it expensive to add blocks or change blocks on the blockchain.
So, when you read the white paper, and you thought that this might work, how did you feel when you read that?
Yeah, I mean, it was exciting to read about. And so the next thing that I thought to myself was, well, now I need to actually use it. I need to try it out. I need to see for myself whether or not I think that it actually holds up to the promise of this 9-page paper. And that is where things started to get a little tricky, because there were no exchanges in the United States that you could just hook a bank account up to. I ended up having to go actually to my North Carolina State Employees Credit Union bank, and that I had as a result of working at the University of North Carolina while I was a student, and I had to ask them, hey, can you help me send an international wire transfer? And I had never sent a wire transfer in my life before, and I ended up spending nearly an hour at the bank, filling out paperwork, talking to one of the managers at the bank, who kept imploring that I needed to understand that once this money left my account, there was no way to get it back. And I needed to be really, really sure that I wasn't getting scammed, into some, fake digital coin scheme, because they didn't know what Bitcoin was. I took a chance, and it took, I think, a few weeks to get that all sent and settled and get my Bitcoin from this little exchange called MT Gox in Japan. And that's where things really started getting interesting.
So what year was it that you found Bitcoin and read the white paper and made that first wire transfer?
That was 2012.
2012. Okay. So pretty early there. And your first Bitcoin buy was from Mt. Gox.
Yeah. It wasn't, I think, until a year or two later that Coinbase really started opening up and onboarding a lot of Americans. Because I tell you, sending those wire transfers is very annoying.
Yeah. And for all the Satillionaires out there who don't know, Mt. Gox ended up going belly up effectively, right? Because I'm not sure exactly what they did. Maybe they claimed to have more Bitcoin than they did, or they were being, what happened there?
It's a very long story. But as best we can tell, it seems like Gox got hacked multiple times, and that it likely got hacked and was already technically insolvent even back in 2012 when I was using it. I think from looking at some of the on-chain analysis, like it looked like it had been hemorrhaging coins essentially ever since inception, like before Mark Karpeles even took over from Jeb McCaleb. And so they were able to operate, I think, for a number of years while they were technically insolvent. But then it was in the real run-up to over $1,000 in 2014 where it just, the problem spiraled out of control. They couldn't keep up with it. And too many people were requesting to take their coins off the exchange. And eventually they just ran out of coins. And then that turned into a decade long bankruptcy process. I think it was one of the longest ever bankruptcy processes in world history. And also one of the most unique in the sense that it was the first company to ever magically go from insolvent to solvent, like while it was going through this really long bankruptcy process, simply because the value of the coins that they ended up finding later that they still had left just went up by so much.
So wild.
That is so insane. Wild. Did you take those into self-custody from Mt. Gox, or did you leave them on the exchange for a time?
So, you know, thankfully, I understood what self-custody was. I think a lot of people didn't even know at the time. And so I was, you know, fortunate enough to avoid that particular disaster. But, you know, if you've been in Bitcoin long enough, you're going to get burned by something at some point. You know, there's just so many services have gone under over the years. I've lost way more Bitcoin than I ever want to think about. It's a, you know, it's a very painful thing. So one thing that I say is that, you know, one of the hardest aspects about Bitcoin is that it really is this game of attrition. And basically, it's this game of holding on to and keeping your coins safe from the myriad of things that can go wrong. And I would say most of the things that can go wrong are usually related to when you leave your money with a trusted third party.
Wow. So, you know, the best term we have for guys like you are, you know, bare metal Bitcoiners is what we say, where there really wasn't this world of connecting in your Siku bank account to, you know, Coinbase. I mean, and you couldn't even necessarily get it easily. You know, where, what technology did you all even have back in 2012 to store your own Bitcoin?
Right. Yeah. So acquiring it was hard. There were some really convoluted ways of acquiring it. There was like the MoneyGram Red Phone, I think, where you could go into certain like certain drug stores that had these ways of sending money where you could essentially do like a peer-to-peer trade using the Red Phone. One thing that people did was they would actually buy Second Life Linden dollars, and there would be places where you could trade these other types of digital currency for Bitcoin. But it was like, how do you get the Linden dollars in the first place? And so you'd have to go through all these really sketchy middleman services and do multiple swaps. But as you mentioned, we did not have many great self-custody options, and Trezor didn't launch until 2014. That was the first, you know, dedicated hardware security device. So really the main option back then was you're actually going to run Bitcoin Core. You know, you're going to run the node, you're going to use the wallet on the node, and that's going to be how you secure your coins. If you wanted to get really crazy, you would try to use something like Glacier Protocol to do this all on an offline computer. But I would say probably like 0.01% of people would try to do air-gapped computer stuff. If they even understood what that was, it was just really, really onerous. And so the nice thing of what we've done over the past decade is continue to improve those best practices and make the best practices more user-friendly so that people can follow them without having to be, you know, a computer science expert.
So, by the way, that's crazy. So you needed to almost operate your own full node in order to store your Bitcoin in self-custody at that stage, because the Bitcoin Core had that kind of wallet built in.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't too difficult in the sense that, you know, you download the Bitcoin software and run it, though I think a lot of people would get thrown for a loop because you would have to spend hours or days, you know, downloading, syncing the blockchain and before you could really use the wallet itself. But also, this was a dangerous thing because you're keeping all of your keys most likely on your day-to-day desktop or laptop. The only nice thing was that, you know, back then there were far fewer hackers that were going around, you know, trying to break into your computer. So the threat landscape has greatly changed over the past 10 years as the entire space has gone more mainstream, as there is a greater diversity and wealth of juicy targets for various types of criminals to try to go after in a variety of different ways.
So, you know, once you and I do want our Satillionaires to get some advice from you on how to be secure as they're stacking their first sats. But before we do, when you decided to start playing around with Bitcoin, you know, what did you find? Did Bitcoin hold up to the promise of the white paper? How did that make you feel to start working with it in that way?
I mean, the first thing that I did was just, you know, try to find a few retail type sites where I could just use it to buy stuff. And it's, you know, once you then conduct some sort of transaction where you're receiving something else of value, that's when you're like, okay, people are actually agreeing that this thing has value because I can see that I can exchange it for other stuff. So that was the first thing that really got me past the skepticism that this is just internet funny money that is all a giant scam, even if the system itself seems sound. Pretty quickly after that, though, I started putting my computer science skills to work, and I actually forked the Bitcoin Core repository, added in about 1,000 lines of code to collect metrics. And the main reason for this was that I understood that, you know, the great premise, the ethos that Bitcoin rests upon is this idea of open source transparency. You know, we can all see what the system is doing. And as a result, I saw a gap where it seemed like running a node did not have that same level of transparency. And so this is where I created the Satoshi project. You can still go today to satoshi.info and you can see one of my Bitcoin nodes and see all these pretty graphs, charts, metrics to see like what the actual internal operations are that that node is doing. And I think that was a good starter project. It got referenced by a number of developers over the years to make different arguments about improvements to Bitcoin.
Wow. Can you imagine understanding enough about Bitcoin to crack open the code and add some to it?
No.
That is a mind-blowing thing right there. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But that didn't... are you still able to use that today? Like, I mean, do people have to adopt that fork, or it just allows you to collect info about that node for your research project?
Yeah, I mean, this is only really, you know, if you want to understand what your node is doing. So there are a few people that run that fork, but I'm just keeping it updated because Bitcoin Core does 2 releases per year. So twice per year, I just pull down all of the code changes, recompile my fork, and put it back out there for people to use. But, you know, for the average person, you know, you can just go to my website and that will give you a lot of the pretty charts that most other nodes, if you were running it yourself, would look pretty similar.
So after you got through your early days, what was it like for you to mature into, you know, deeper levels, right? We've had some guests on the show who stacked sats pretty early. And as the exchange rate, right? I used to say the price of Bitcoin. I'm done with that. That's silly.
Yeah. I prefer exchange rate.
Come on now. Bitcoin is money. Come on. They're still trying to make us think in terms of dollars. I'm not going to do it. So as the exchange rate, you know, went upward, what did that mean for you? How did Bitcoin change your life?
Well, I mean, the short answer is yes, though not so much, you know, because of wealth. You know, we could go down this particular rabbit hole. You know, there's a number of different types of people who adopted Bitcoin, and in general, the cohorts of the types of people who have adopted it over different cycles have generally changed. But if we look at the people who adopted it around the time that I did, which was, you know, right around the first halving, you know, within the first 4 years, you know, possibly even within the first 6 or 7 years, those tended to be the cypherpunks, the crypto anarchists, the anarcho-capitalists. We were just trying to build a parallel system. And sure, there were people who had sort of gold bug-esque long-term views of what could happen with the exchange rate. But at least in my circles, I felt like, you know, we were mainly looking at Bitcoin as a currency, not as a digital gold or long-term investment. My investment thesis for Bitcoin from the very beginning was really like a 30-year investment thesis. And it was always this idea, and I've repeated this mantra many times over the years, that there's no guarantee that the exchange rate of Bitcoin is going to go up. But we do have basically a guarantee that the value of fiat is going to go down. So I always just saw it as, you know, a multi-decade hedge against the constant devaluation of fiat. It has vastly exceeded my expectations in terms of exchange rate, but that was never my primary motivation. And, you know, as a result, I kind of put myself in the camp of people who kind of accidentally lucked into winning on the investment side because I didn't care about that. I was never really trading it. For me, it was buy, hold for a really, really long time. And then maybe at some point in the future, there's something else that you would want to exchange for it. But I'm really more focused on the freedom aspects of the technology. And so, you know, if we start getting into some of the more nitty-gritty technical aspects in my long-term views, I may actually sound to a lot of people like I'm very bearish, because there's a lot of things that I am not satisfied with. I see so much room for improvement for Bitcoin from like a protocol level, a technical level, an adoption level, that I actually think in some ways like the value of Bitcoin as a system has greatly outpaced where we're at in terms of being able to deliver the freedom, the security, the sovereignty that the protocol affords, being able to deliver that to the masses. And that's also why I've spent the past decade building self-custody wallets, because I feel like there's still a big gap there, that the responsibility that is required, that onus of taking this value into your own hands and not being able to just point at a third party and say, oh, it's your responsibility. That's still very off-putting for a lot of people. And that's why we need to continue to make it easier for people to feel confident that they can be their own bank. Hmm.
Wow. I do feel like there is a lot of people who are Bitcoiners and talk about Bitcoin as effectively an immaculate conception. It's perfect money. I guess to use a different mythology, you know, almost sprang whole from the head of Zeus, so to speak, like Athena. But it did have bugs in its early days, right? I mean, it is simply software, and it can be hard for people to understand that a piece of software or some code or a protocol can be money, because we're just used to software getting updated all the time or crashing or, you know, coming in and out of popularity. So for someone with your level of knowledge about Bitcoin, what are some ways that Bitcoin could get better?
Ooh. Also, this is the fun part, because anytime you try to suggest a change to Bitcoin, there's probably going to be controversy and pushback. But we're at a point right now where the rate of upgrades to the protocol has been slowing. 10 years ago, we were making updates to the protocol almost on an annual basis. And then what happened in 2016, 2017, we had the fork wars, the scaling wars. And that really burned out a lot of deep thinkers in this space. And so the rate of change and improvements after that has really dropped off to like maybe one thing every 3 years or so. And so at this point, I think it's been about 3 years since our last update with Taproot. And so I'm worried about that particular trend and about how, it's going to get harder and harder to make changes. This is due to something called ossification, which is basically a law of physics for any network protocol. As the size of the network grows, it becomes harder and harder to coordinate change. But there's a lot of things that I would love to see improved, and we actually have a number of improvement proposals out there right now that are being debated. These things like check template verify, which would give a number of different new pieces of functionality, something called covenants. Covenants are basically a way to put forward-looking restrictions on the flow of your money. If that doesn't make much sense, just think of it as the way the Bitcoin works right now. You have the ability to define the spending conditions for your Bitcoin. Now, for most people, that just means you're going to create an address that has this locking script behind it that says, I need one cryptographic signature that matches this public key. And that's really all there is to it. But Bitcoin has a much more complex scripting language with more functionality than just checking signatures. And what it can only do today is let you create those spending conditions for where the Bitcoin is right now. With something like covenants, you could say, okay, not only do we only let you move the money if you have, you know, this signature or these set of signatures or this lock time or whatever, but you can say, and the money can only go to these places. And then these places have their own spending conditions. And so that allows you to create much more interesting game theory. For example, you can create things called vaults, where think of it as you can say, okay, my money can only go to this one address that is then time locked and has these other spending conditions. And that actually gives you a type of escape hatch, in the sense that you have time to react if those funds are moved without your permission. You know, you could say this gets locked up for a couple of weeks, and during that period of time, I can essentially move the funds myself to a different place if they got moved from the original vault without my permission. So I find that interesting because that is kind of a missing aspect of security. It's kind of like the other side of the coin to Bitcoin security, where right now we only have proactive security. You basically have to create this really high wall of cybersecurity and even physical security around your keys, because if they fall into the wrong hands or they get lost, then it's game over. You know, it's catastrophic loss and no one can get you your money back. But with something like vaults, you would have reactive security. It wouldn't just be a one layer of security type of mechanism, but rather you would have a fallback. And if something went wrong, you could still recover from it. And that's one of the primary things that we've been focused on for the past 7 years at Casa, is giving people the ability to recover from mistakes, from failures, really from anything that can go wrong. I think that that's one of the biggest missing pieces when it comes to self-custody. Custody in general is allowing people to be human, allowing them to make mistakes, allowing for failures to happen, but architecting your setup in such a way that a failure isn't catastrophic. I think that's been one of the biggest turnoffs to people from taking on responsibility for self-custody this entire time.
So it's almost like I could take my Bitcoin and set up some of these rules and covenants to where if the Lazarus group jumps onto my laptop and gets past all my, protections, as modest as they might be, and is able to get into that desktop wallet I have, for example, and say, all right, well, we're going to shoot this out of here. So that we can grab it, it would in fact only drop into a predetermined vault that would, you know, almost be like a panic room for my Bitcoin. And then I could then, allow my brain to come back down to earth and figure out how I can save my own Bitcoin instead of watching it just go off into the ether.
Yep. Yeah. And, check, tipple, and verify, and some of the other proposals that are out there can also improve existing technologies. Several of them have ways where they can actually greatly improve the flexibility and scalability of Lightning Network, for example. And Lightning Network has been running, you know, also for about 7 years now in production, and it's gotten a decent amount of adoption, but it's, you know, sufficiently complex that I think you have to be really far down the Bitcoin rabbit hole in order to start using it. And there's a lot of potential for us to continue improving a lot of aspects around just, you know, managing channels and liquidity and keys and being able to essentially share channels and liquidity with other people, which would be, you know, more scalable, potentially more private.
Right. It's almost like we're having to, you know, we kind of built our own money network, and now we're building our own. Almost, it's not like a credit card network, but it is like a high speed transactional type space that's just run by ordinary people around the world. So you mentioned, you know, this idea of being interested in the freedom aspects of Bitcoin and, you know, coming in with a class of anarcho-capitalists and cypherpunks, who want to build a parallel system. So what do you see Bitcoin doing over like centuries? And do you think that we're still on track for that vision you have? Or do you think that, you know, all our guys in Wall Street are kind of vacuuming up all the Bitcoin and it's going in a different direction now?
Yeah, I mean, that is the great battle that I've been fighting for the past 10 years, is that I like to say at Casa, we are essentially fighting against human nature. Human nature generally is to choose convenience at the expense of almost all else. And so I think that's one of the most dangerous mindsets that is really baked into civilization, just due to how civilization is architected. You know, over the millennia, we have greatly improved the efficiency and the evolution of our economies through this concept of specialization of tasks. You know, that allows you to do one thing really, really well, and then as a result, you don't have to, and you spend a significant portion of your life dealing with menial things like raising livestock and agricultural stuff and so on, because you outsource those tasks to someone who can do them much more efficiently. And as a result, you know, everybody benefits because we're all much more efficient at the things that we do for work. And then we use money to trade, you know, with other people who are more efficient at doing other things. The downside to that is that it creates this systemic fragility within the entire system. So for example, if our supply chains broke down, if the grocery store is closed, we would be having a lot of problems within a week or so. This entire industrial civilization would really grind to a halt, because the result is we're just not self-sufficient anymore. So that's one of the main trade-offs that we make. And my point here is that it has become ingrained in us to outsource tasks that we're not good at or that we simply don't want to do for whatever reason. And so it's very easy, because of how people are already used to interacting with the rest of their financial accounts and life, to just you know, leave your Bitcoin with a trusted third party and not think about or worry about, you know, the responsibility that comes with securing those coins. So I think it's very easy for people to kind of hand wave away the counterparty risks when it comes to Bitcoin, even though we have a very lengthy 15-year history where counterparties are failing on a regular basis. I mean, look, we had the biggest hack of the entire crypto ecosystem just a week or two ago, something, you know, what was it, $1.5 billion worth. So it's not going to stop. You know, counterparties are going to continue to fail. They're going to continue to have issues of trust, and, you know, they act as black boxes where you don't really know what's going on behind the scenes. So there's still, like I said, a lot of room for improvement here. That's why we're trying to make self-custody easier. It is fighting against this systemic risk. You know, there's many different vectors of centralization and decentralization, even just within the Bitcoin ecosystem. But one of the big ones is, I think, custody of coins. The more coins that are concentrated into fewer hands, that just creates honeypots. It creates systemic risk, either from, you know, insider theft or failure, or even, well, obviously, like hacks, they make really juicy targets for various type of attackers, or even 6102 type of attacks, right? Nation state confiscation, much more easy for a nation state to do when they only have to kick down one door opposed to kicking down millions of doors.
Wow. You know, I'm familiar with the 51% attack, and we've talked about 6102 on this show. We hope our Satillionaires out there have heard it enough times to know what it is. But I love the idea of a 6102 attack. That's like that. That's a new way to kind of frame that up. That's a nation state attack on your money there. So
terrified by that idea.
Yeah. Man. Well, I mean, I think that a lot of people haven't really dug into what actually happened after the 6102 order. I actually remember talking to my own grandfather about it when I was a wee lad, because they had gold and they didn't turn their gold into the government. They hid it. And that was actually the common thing for people that were actually physically holding their own gold. What really happened after the 6102 attacks was it was the major brokers and warehouses, the trusted third parties that were holding gold on behalf of a lot of other people. Those were the ones where the gold actually got seized, confiscated, frozen, so on and so forth.
So Jameson's grandfather wasn't repping a North Carolina First in Flight license plate with Bitcoin on it behind him in his camera feed. It was a North Carolina First in Flight license plate that said, "Not my gold. You're not taking my gold, dude. You can't come find my gold. Come try to find my gold." What a great story too. Yeah. For the Satillionaire out there, Jameson, this is the first show they've listened to. Maybe they're a young type with an interest in software engineering. What would be your recommendation for stacking their first sats, taking some steps to secure themselves, and, you know, maybe diving deeper into Bitcoin?
From a trading perspective, I think you should just look at it as a really long-term savings account. That's what worked out for me. I think if you're an active trader, if you're like looking at the exchange rate and then you're making decisions based on that, it's a lot more likely that you're going to get burned. So, you know, dollar cost average, you know, on a weekly or monthly basis, you can set up automatic recurring buys through a lot of the different services out there. I think River makes it pretty easy. I'm pretty sure even Coinbase does. Then the question is, I mean, what level of security do you need for these funds? I tend to break it down into a few different tiers. There's pocket money. If it's, you know, the amount of cash that you would walk around in your wallet, then it's probably fine leaving it on the exchange or having it in a hot wallet, because losing it is not going to be the end of the world. Once you get into the level of, you know, thousands of dollars worth, that's when I think it starts to make sense to invest, you know, $50 to $100 in one of the more popular hardware devices out there, whether that's Trezor, Ledger, Cold Card, Passport, Bitbox. Really any of the popular ones, they're all good. None of them are perfect. Everything has trade-offs. I don't specifically endorse one over the others. Just any of the popular ones are going to be great. And that will protect you from like 95% of the problems just by getting your keys off the internet. At that point, your biggest problem generally becomes robustness against loss. So you want to make sure that you have really good backups. I have some very long articles with my thoughts about how to do backups, but basically you want to have multiple redundant offline backups. You know, you don't want to keep them in the cloud or on your computer. That's where a lot of hacks happen once again. And then beyond that, it's like, you know, if you get to the point where you have a meaningful portion of your portfolio, of your net worth in Bitcoin, that's when you want to take that final step and you want to say, okay, how do I get myself into a position where there's no single points of failure? Because you know, even if you're using a hardware device, if you're using any sort of single signature wallet, which is generally the default in this space, it's right there in the name, single. As a single point of failure, there are things that can go wrong if those keys are lost or fall into the wrong hands. And so the only way that you can really eliminate single points of failure is by having a lot of robustness and resilience and having multiple keys that are protecting your funds. And that's what we really help people do at Casa. We help you get into a multi-sig setup where you're using multiple devices, multiple different software, hardware, keeping the keys in geographically dispersed locations so that various disasters or, even home break-ins or your house burning down or whatever, or flood, famine, you know, any sort of act that can cause destruction of material does not affect enough of your keys that you actually lose access to your funds. And so, you know, this is a really complicated thing to think about because you basically have to think about every possible thing that could go wrong. But we've been doing that now for 7 years. And think of it as, you know, if you put yourself into a Casa setup where you're just following along with the instructions from the software, what it's really doing is it's just guiding you through the best practices of what we've developed over the past decade from seeing a lot of catastrophes and learning from them.
So, you know, what happens though if, so we had number 27 Adam on the show. He mined Bitcoin early on, 400 Bitcoin on his laptop, threw away the laptop. By the time he realized he had thrown it away, he's like, whatever, it was only worth $60, right? It was pocket money at that time. But in today's terms, it's, you know, 40 million. So, you know, what happens for someone who realizes that today's pocket money is tomorrow's generational wealth? Do you need to just go ahead and get it onto a hardware wallet, or, you know, how do you solve that conundrum?
I think the easy way to think about it is you should take whatever the current value of your holdings are and 10x them, because, you know, the exchange rate is volatile and over the period of a few months, it could do a 10x, and you don't want to be caught unawares. You don't want to have $100 level of security on something that becomes worth thousands of dollars. You don't want to have $1,000 level on something that could be worth $100,000, so on and so forth. But it's also just one of those things that happens naturally, especially if you're in the space long enough. You probably have multiple wallets laying around with dust in them and you forget about some of them. And then maybe someday you come back to them and you find there's, you know, thousands of dollars in there. But I think you just need to stay plugged in and maintain your setups. This is not something that I recommend setting up and walking away from. You know, I think a lot of people have this idea of, you know, I buy my gold, I bury it in the ground, and I come back in 10 years. But like I said, this is software and technology, and it's a constantly changing environment. So you want to have at least some high level of ongoing, like keeping up with what's going on, because there are things that could happen.
So we're gonna do a couple things here, Jameson. Number one, we ask all of our guests if they would come back on the show in 9 months to give us an update on their Bitcoin baby. Would you be willing to do that for us?
No problem.
We love that. Number two, we want people to know where they can find you, your website, which is an absolute, I would say gold mine, but it's more like a Bitcoin mine of information, your company Casa. Where can people find, you to engage with you? Where can they find your company to engage with that?
Yeah, I'm on X. My handle is just my last name, LOPP. You can check out my educational Bitcoin resources at bitcoin.page. You can check out Casa at casa.io.
And isn't there like a lop.net or?
Yeah, so bitcoin.page goes to lop.net. I just figure it's easier for people to remember.
Okay. All right, so we're going to make you an offer here. But before we do, we're going to taste some hummus. And I'm going to let Chris introduce this. Because it seems like it's this is a kind of like a special debut.
Kind of.
It's actually huge.
Okay.
I'm underselling it.
This is a brand new hummus by Ithaca. It is a partnership with Graza Olive Oil. So
it's that big green bottle.
Olive oil, sea salt, and everything else that you know and love from Ithaca. So we're gonna have a quick taste of this.
This has never appeared on the show before. So let's give this a try. Ready?
Yep. Wow. Olive oil. Sea salt. So good.
Mmm. Wow. It's like hummus flavor, nice fresh olive oil flavor, and then it's like some like salt flavor at the end.
Yep. Yep.
Oh my gosh.
Can't beat that.
Talk about holding down the center of a charcuterie board. That is delicious. So let's make Jameson his offer.
All right, Jameson. So as a small token of our appreciation here at Sat Chats, we believe in exchanging value for value. So we're going to make you an offer and you'll have your choice between 50 USD, which we've got framed here, encased in glass. I'll give that to Stuart to hold now that he can hold it.
Yep.
Or $50 worth of sats, which if I go to the Clark Moody dashboard behind me, oh my gosh, the price of one Bitcoin right now is $79,540.
Dipping below 80K.
Okay, great time to buy if you're like that. Or that translates into 1,257 sats per dollar, 1,257 times 50.
Holy smokes.
That is the highest sats offering we have ever made on this show. 62,850 sats or 50 USD. What's it going to be, Jameson?
Is there any numismatic value to that $50 bill?
There is none. We're gonna pull this musty, crusty bill out and send it to you if that's what you want. Or 62,850 sats.
Sats it is.
Yes, sir. Let's go. My guy Jameson with the sats. So you bring our score to 30 guests who chose sats versus 3 who chose the cash. So thank you so much for coming on the show, Jameson. For all our satillionaires out there, it's bitcoin.page for an absolute host of resources, along with casa.io. If you're in that third tier of needing to secure your Bitcoin, avoid that single point of failure. Because today's pocket cash is tomorrow's generational wealth. Let's go.
Yeah.
Holy smoke. So give us your value for our value. Like and subscribe if you enjoyed our chat about sats today with Jameson. 5 stars on Spotify. I'm sure there's numismatic value somewhere on that platform as well.
you gotta search for it though.
Help us get to 999 plus one subscribers as soon as humanly possible. We will choose one from among you and drop 1,000,000 sats right on top of you, make you an instant satillionaire. Thanks so much for listening today. And remember, Sat Chats is for educational purposes only and should not be construed as financial advice. Also, our guests' views are their own.